This is Jeff McDonald, and you're listening to the Ideas Architect podcast, episode number 85. Hi, folks. This is Jeff McDonald. Welcome to the Ideas Architect podcast, where we talk about how to design, build, and sell your ideas. And today we've got an author who's just published her third book, which is pretty spectacular. And even more exciting is she's actually published it or co-written it with two other authors, and I'm not sure that I could actually do that. So that's a pretty good achievement in itself. So we're talking with Corinne Armour, and Corinne's real passion is about fearless leadership and ultimately overcoming waste. She's on a war on wasted potential. Enjoy the show. Hi, Corinne. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jeff. It's delightful to be here.
Yeah, it's been a while since we've talked. So tell me and the rest of the people listening, what do you do and what's your area of interest?
My area of interest is fearless leadership. And, you know, there's lots of academic, complex, fancy ways of describing what I do. But at its most simple, I help leaders and teams get out of their own way and fulfill their potential. So that's speaking, training, coaching, mentoring. That's helping leaders and teams get out of their own way and fulfill their potential.
I think most of us can relate to that. I saw the testimonial on your website from someone. I just think, yeah, that's me most of the time. I think I'm the biggest stop to my own potential, because I noticed I love your line around waging a war on wasted potential. Is that the key to it? That's the driver?
It is. It's something that I'm really fired up about at the moment. And when I look around, if you think about our engagement rates, employee engagement rates in Australia, 24% of people are engaged. So one in four. So if you think about three people you work with, and you, if you think you're engaged, then statistically the other three are not. And then it gets even worse, because one of those other three are probably actively undermining the organization's success.
Wow.
So there's so much wasted potential. And we create that wasted potential for ourselves because we're afraid of being successful. We're afraid of failing. We've got organizational systems that build in waste. We've got cultural systems that build in waste. It's something I'm really passionate about.
And I love your line around productivity tax. I think that nails it beautifully. Like, we've taxed our own efforts, but so what's driving that? Like, that's such a ridiculous result. What are some of the things that are causing that?
This is a conversation we could have for days. So let's go with a couple of the headlines.
Yeah.
I think that we focus on the short term, so we're sacrificing the long term. We're even sacrificing the medium term for short-term gains. So we see this, you know, I joke about our political cycle, but we've got a four-year political cycle, and what major infrastructure, what major physical projects can be conceptualized, developed, delivered, implemented, have benefits realized in 4 years? Like, so at a political level, we're thinking really short-term. Around our boardroom tables, we're thinking really short-term. And at an individual level, we're thinking short term. So if we're always thinking about now, tomorrow, then it's impossible to see how big visions can be developed and realized. So I think that's one of the causes for waste. Another cause for waste is that we focus on the behaviours, but we miss the meaning. Mm. And so we're not taking responsibility for the meanings that we're making of things around us. And then that can translate into waste. And then particularly, I think that's a driver of waste for us individually.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting, because I sort of was thinking, is this just the leader problem, or is it just the follower problem? And what you're pointing to, it's both of those, plus it's the environment we're operating in. So it's quite a complex thing.
I think it's all of those things. We just are constantly getting in our own way. I'd like to just wave a magic wand and say, get out of your own way. You are fabulous. You know, you are fabulous the way you are. Just stop wasting your potential and be the brilliance that you could be. That's a challenge for us as leaders, isn't it?
I think it's also the challenge for the follower, though, as well. Like we focus so much on the leader and all the qualities they need, and if they're not getting into the road, it's like maybe it's affecting all their direct reports. But it's also there's got to be something for the followers in that as well as to who they're being and whether they're even supporting the leader.
That's so true. I'm sure you would have seen that YouTube clip that's very popular about the first follower.
Yes.
And the daggy guy. So for anybody who hasn't seen it, I think it must be some sort of an outdoor folk concert. And there's all these people sitting on the lawn and one guy gets up and starts dancing and everyone looks at him as like, who's this crazy dude dancing? But then a second person gets up and dances, and so that's the first follower. And once you've got two people dancing, it's no longer a lone lunatic. It's a person, you know, a leader and a follower. And then there's this huge energy as other people join in, and then lots of people are dancing. And I think that's it. I don't know that we are taught to follow any more than we're taught to lead.
And that's a great example of fearless, because literally when I've watched that video, it's just like, yes, that first guy gets up, clearly an idiot, and doesn't care what people think. And then the second guy's almost a bigger idiot, but at least he's following someone else, so he's not on his own anymore. And is that the simple idea behind fearless, or is there more to it than that?
It is that. For me, fearless is, we had a conversation earlier about setting big goals. And fearless is perhaps something that we will never actually achieve. Because if you're completely fearless, then you're either asleep or dead.
Or a psychopath.
Or in that case, that is a third option. Can tell my sheltered upbringing I wasn't going to go there. So, we don't get to be completely fearless, but it's about fearing less. It's about acknowledging, oh, I feel a bit of a nervousness about this, or, I'm going to have a really difficult performance conversation with Jeff this afternoon, or I've got a front up in front of the media and the key shareholders. You know, I'm feeling a little bit anxious about that. It's about acknowledging that fear's there and that's simply data. And it's there for a good reason, so acknowledge it and use it. Fearless leadership is about having the conversations that need to be had. It's about making the decisions that need to be made. Where organisations get dysfunctional, typically there are decisions that should have been made and that aren't, or communications, really open, honest communications that aren't being had.
Yeah.
I think that's another key driver of the wasted potential, is that we communicate in ways that bruise relationships and bruise other people. And when we're communicating in ways that are really releasing that human potential, we're communicating in ways that build, like that elevate the people around them, around you, rather than push them back in their boxes.
Mm. And is this a new problem, or has this been the perennial problem for leadership? Has it just got worse, maybe?
I think our focus on the short term has perhaps got worse. And I'm thinking about the pressure of social media, of being constantly available, of, you know, who has weekends anymore? Who really, truly has a weekend where when they hit the pub at, you know, drinks after work on Friday at 5 o'clock, don't actually reconnect to their work again until they rock up on Monday morning? People just don't work that way anymore. We're constantly accessible, constantly connected. And I think that adds a level of pressure, and that drives that, you know, I need to respond immediately. I need to do something immediately. And it's the people who are able to put some perspective and some distance and step back from that are those who are more likely to have that creative insight.
Yeah, I've been reading some of the neuroscience around that stuff, and basically what they're now saying is, yes, there's two parts to our brain, but one's the conscious task-focused brain and the other's the non-task-focused stuff. And the creativity comes from the non-task part of the brain when you're walking down the street having a shower, and it's connecting and building the story and narrative of what's going on, as distinct from the task ones, just getting things done. So if you stay there, you don't actually get the space to create anything new.
Exactly. It's like what that thing about walking down the street or when you're in the shower, when your conscious mind is occupied with something mundane and then your unconscious mind is free to do that integration and make those connections.
Yeah, we were talking earlier in the show, it's like, you know, the reason I don't take on more clients is because I really guard the time I need to be thinking around stuff. And sometimes my best work is walking to the shop. And so I actually schedule that in. So after this, I'm actually going to the supermarket and I'm going for a walk for an hour. And you might go, oh, what a luxury that I'm not working. But if I'm actually processing and thinking about something, that might be when I do my best work.
Yeah, I find quite often if I go to the gym in the morning, what I love to be able to do, if the kids haven't realised that I've got back, to spend a couple of minutes in my car just dictating some quick notes or doing a quick something on Evernote. And that's all about capturing the ideas that I had while I was jumping up and down in my most delicate way at the gym.
Yeah, I'm still trying to convince the tax man to claim my walking shoes and my gym membership, but that's another story. Maybe that'll come.
So Jeff, back to the question of what drives wasted potential. Can another big driver of wasted potential is leadership, that we still have many leaders who don't see that developing their people, and in particularly developing the next group of leaders, the next batch of leaders coming through the organisation, that's their major responsibility.
Mm.
And I was working with a woman this morning, so she's an executive of a fairly large organisation, and she was lamenting one of the senior managers who reported to her, and we were working with how she could better support him. And she described him as being technically gifted and running a sweatshop. And what she meant by that was that he was technically very good, but his people were he was focused on the task, incredibly revenue focused, and had earned good results for the organisation last financial year. But it's not sustainable because his people feel unsupported. They don't feel heard. And it was really a strong case of focusing on task over people instead of being able to balance the two. And interestingly, I'll tell you a little bit more about my book in a minute, but she had come to the launch of my book last week, and I said to her, have you had a chance to read it yet? And she said, no, I'm carrying it around with me. I haven't read it yet. It is only two working days or three working days since the launch. So I did forgive her for that. And so I referred her to the page there where we look at what are the unconscious behaviours, what are the intentions and even the unconscious intentions behind a behaviour that looks like focusing on people over task. But if we've got leaders who aren't developing their people and people who aren't feeling developed, then that's a massive waste of potential.
Mm. Yeah, because I think this it's all nested in the short-term thing. The short-term leadership used to be, I need to manage you to get this job done. Whereas if you go long-term, you start to think about how do we grow the organisation, and therefore the frame of what leadership is in that context is very different.
Absolutely. So can I tell you about the book?
Yes, please do.
It's a little bit like you get excited as a kid because Christmas is coming.
Oh, absolutely. How many times in your life do you publish a book? If you're not going to get excited by that, you've got trouble.
but more the thing about Christmas is that you keep thinking like Christmas is tomorrow, and I know it's tomorrow because the decorations are up in the shop.
Yeah.
But then your mother says, actually, no, it's just the 1st of December. And then you really know it's Christmas tomorrow because everywhere there's Christmas carols, but it's just the week before Christmas. So it's a bit like that when you publish a book. It's like this whole series of false deadlines. So it's finally now been birthed. And it's written for leaders who lead leaders. So it's written for people who themselves are leaders and have leaders reporting to them. And having said that, it is very useful for those leaders themselves as well. It doesn't just have to be for other people. So it's called Developing Direct Reports, Taking the Guesswork Out of Leading Leaders. And that's exactly what it is, taking the guesswork out of leading leaders. There's so many books on the market about developing your own leadership, and there's books about developing leadership teams and what gets in the way. But there's nothing on the market that addresses what are the archetypal leadership challenges that we face. What are the derailers that on their journey that leaders come up against? And so we look at 12 globally recognized leadership derailers like analysis paralysis. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're not guilty from time to time of analysis paralysis, I'm sure you know somebody who is.
Oh, no, it wouldn't be me.
Someone who can't delegate. You know, we've all at sometimes come up against a leader or someone who reports to us who really struggles to delegate, and what's the implications of that on the team. Micromanagers, someone who wants to be involved in everything and then consequently disempowers the people around them and slows everything down. Someone who's a people burner, so they've got really poor people skills, and we talked just a minute ago about someone who's more command and control. So this is my way or the highway. And these are classic archetypes or derailers that most people recognize. And interestingly, as people read it, if I could tell exactly where they were on the page, I could tell which one they think they're guilty of, because that's when the little smile plays around on their lips as they read it.
Oh, that's clever. That's the coach in you, isn't it?
That is the coach in me. And I've written this with two colleagues, Belinda Cohen and Annalie Blundell, and we're all speakers and trainers, and we all have a coaching background. So it's very much about a coaching approach to developing leaders. And it's also driven by our frustration that so many leaders are quick to outsource the problem. Mm. So, you know, we've got trouble with Jeff. Mm. You know, we think he's got good intentions, but he just can't delegate. So we'll send him off on a time management course, and we'll send him on a delegation skills course. So we're very quick to outsource the problem, and we spend a fortune on training. But if it's not well targeted, then it's more of that waste that we were talking about. And if Jeff's problem is actually something about his beliefs and his understandings about himself and the world that are causing his lack of delegation, and not the fact that he doesn't know how to delegate. You could be technically very good at delegation. You could teach me to delegate, but that doesn't mean that you'll do it.
Yeah.
So we're really looking at what's the intentions that drive the behaviour rather than directly at the behaviour.
Yeah, because it's also, I think, the training, it's like reading books. It's like, yeah, you can read a lot of books and learn a lot of stuff, but unless it's put into action, it's almost wasted knowledge. And I think this embedding of it and working in the field with people is so crucial to leadership, because you can't do it on your own.
Absolutely. And if you think about the 70-20-10 model of learning, which says that it's only 10% of our learning that we do in formal classroom type leadership program type situations.
Yeah.
And then there's 20% that's sort of semi-formal on the job type learning, like coaching or a specific performance conversation that we might have. But 70% of it is actually applied learning by doing things, by watching, by trying things out in the workplace. And sending someone on a delegation program, for example, that's the 10%, and then we hope that they're fixed when they come back.
Yeah.
We're probably not going to do any follow-up. Whereas if we can bring that increased awareness of what's driving this behavior, what are the real issues, how else can we address the concerns that are driving these issues, we bring that back into the workplace, we're going to have much greater chance of success, and we're going to be building stronger leaders as we do it.
Mm. Yeah, I've just been reading, where is it here, Marshall Goldsmith and his book on triggers, and he talks about the role of the environment and how that shapes what we do and how the environment triggers us. And I think that's another conversation for leaders. That maybe that's your next book, but it's like, what's this context that the leader is actually operating in? So we can send them away to a training and they learn certain things, but if the environment's not conducive for those things to be applied, then nothing happens as well.
Absolutely. And how, what's the role of the learner and what's the role of the leader in triggering those behaviours back in the workplace?
Yeah.
And how do we ensure that the new behaviours are supported? Beautiful segue to Marshall Goldsmith, I have to say, Jeff, because he's actually written an endorsement for us, a fabulous endorsement, which we were very proud of.
So, he's one of the top business coaches in the world, so that's fantastic.
Yeah, we were delighted that he was so pleased with it. So Triggers is on my reading list. I haven't actually read it yet, but it is on my list.
I think it's brilliant. It's a beautiful, simple methodology that cuts to the chase of a whole bunch of stuff, so I think you'll enjoy it.
I think so too. He's a great leader. I think the book of his that I give most to clients is What Got You Here Won't Get You There.
Oh, yes, yes.
And even if they just read the cover and they read What Got You Here Won't Get You There, yeah, and they actually think about that, then my work is half done.
Yes. I think it's one of the best book titles I've ever heard, because it literally tells you, it presents the problem and the solution in the same thing, and you could almost just reflect on that, because I think there's miles of learning to be had just on that one line.
Oh, exactly. And one of the concepts that I like in that book is his concept of, as we become more senior, more successful as leaders, we develop this really firm idea of our strengths, and we think that that's what's caused our success.
Mm.
And so I'll quite often use his approach of working with you on, okay, let's look at what you think your key strengths are and which are those that you're successful because of them. So those things, you know, there is a definite link between you having those strengths and your success. And which are the things that you are successful in spite of?
Mm.
And that I think going back to before, we were talking before about communication that builds and not bruises.
Yep.
That's a classic example of that. You know, you work with someone who says, well, my team like working with me, and it's really important because they know exactly where they stand with me. There's never any doubt what I think. Yes, that may be true. And there's a trail of carnage behind you.
Yes.
And if we could have you be just as direct and just as transparent with a degree of empathy and more ways to communicate that actually build relationships, how powerful could you be?
Yeah, I think it's the simple one of, yes, that's great in that situation, but maybe it's not so great in the other 8% of the times people interact with you. So,
exactly.
So tell me more about that. I noticed on your website you've got some fabulous white papers there. Are they part of the research from, like, you've now written 3 books, so that's pretty impressive. And you've also got the white papers, so were they fuel for writing the books, or are they different?
No, they're all separate. So the book, there will be a white paper that sits with the book, which I think we're hoping to publish next week or the week after. And it's around the angle that training is broken professional development is, leadership development is broken.
Yeah.
And it's broken because of the things that we started to talk about before. And here's another way of thinking about it. So that's the white paper that sits with the book. The other white papers are around, so that's our collective IP. The leading leaders and developing direct reports is work that I've developed with Annalie and Belinda, my co-authors. And the work that I've done solo is around the fearless leadership and leading change.
Yeah.
And we put so much effort, there's some more wasted potential for you. Wasted potential is the overarching theme of all of this. We put so much energy into change, and yet research says that up to 70% of our organisational change initiatives fail.
That is so unbelievably bad. Like
unbelievably bad. I think about the waste of financial resource with that. Like, what else are we not able to do for our clients, our shareholders, our community because of that waste? But I also think about the human waste of the people who have been involved in making that change. Now, some who might have come on the journey and some who weren't able to come on that journey. What's the energy cost for them, the implications on their lives outside work because they're worried about these changes?
Is it the same 70 people that are disengaged from work? Is that why it's failing?
I think there are some definite connections there, but maybe it's more that if we were better with change, we wouldn't have so many people disconnected.
Yeah.
So, I think all of these things are connected. But the book is, as I said, it's about leading leaders. And the idea that we first, rather than sending someone off, let's go and let's fix them by training them, let's actually discover what's the problem, what's actually going on here, and let's build the leader's awareness and build the leader's awareness and the direct reports awareness around what really is the problem here. And then once we understand that, what's the cause of it? Let's decode it. You know, what's your motivation for behaving in this way? It's the behaviors that we're not happy with, but what's the intention behind that? And how else can we have those needs met that serve everybody more effectively? And then what's the action? What do we need to do about that? So let's design the pathway forward to support development.
Mm.
And like you were talking about there with Marshall Goldsmith and the triggers, what's the context? Because we need to think about what's the environment that we're playing in here, and what's the implication of that on displaying particular skills?
Mm.
And we say that we want a particular skill. You know, we say that we want people who are innovative, for example. And so we'll spend quite a lot of energy encouraging the skills and the competencies around innovation. But don't you dare fail, because we're highly risk averse. So the environment that we're creating isn't supporting the competencies that we're trying to develop.
Yeah, one of my theories, I've done a few books for Bookwrapper around the leadership stuff and how it goes from the trait theory that our leaders need to have these qualities to the one that shifted it for me was the book by Goffey and Jones, where they talk about why should we be led by you? And they basically bring it back to authenticity and the situational nature of leadership, that it's not about having one set of traits, but it's about being responsive to whatever's going around you. And I think this is part of where you're pointing to. It's like we've tried to simplify it too much, as if there was one way of doing things, but the world and people and relationships are way more complex than that. So we need to be way more flexible about how we do things rather than just having one approach.
That's so true. It's about being flexible, and it's also about thinking, what's really going on for this person? and in our situation. So can I give you an example?
Yes, yes.
If we think about someone who's a fence sitter, so, you know, I'm sure that you, Jeff, and probably everyone who's listening can think of somebody they know who's a fence sitter. And so we think about, well, what's that fence sitting person saying? And she's probably saying things like, what do other people think here? So there's that outward focus. But what's she thinking? And she's thinking that it's really important that we make a good decision. And I need to gather all valid ideas and I need to collect all the data. And I'm conscious that everybody has a voice, so I need to hear everybody. And that consensus is important because when we get consensus, we get ownership. So they're positive intentions that are driving the behavior that looks like fence sitting. But from the outside, we're seeing that, you know, she has too many meetings. She takes forever to make her mind up. So in the meantime, we work around her. When she does make her mind up, she seems like she's uncertain. She's lacking in confidence. And then she might be persuaded easily by other people. But for her, the whole intention is I need to get the right outcome.
Mm.
And then we've got we also take a view of what's the 360 feedback? What's her team likely to be saying? So they're going to be saying things like, she's always asking me what I think. And she says, you know, we need to decide about this. But I'm not the leader. She's the leader. Why is she not deciding? She builds a great team around her, but we're going around in circles because she won't make decisions.
Mm.
And when she runs meetings, they're painful because they take so long. And we're waiting for an answer. And she calls herself a collaborator, and we just think, well, this is death by meeting. So there's all of these conversations going on in people's heads around why is it that she's a fence sitter? And so we really do need to get behind. We need to discover what the problem is. We need to really decode what's the cause of it. Why is it that she won't make decisions? So it could be that she's a perfectionist. It could be that she's afraid of being accountable for a decision that's not successful. It might be just around a decision-making model that's about consensus and the importance of sharing responsibility. It could be that there is just a lack of clarity on what the outcome is, so she's not yet prepared to make a judgment.
Mm.
And until we can really understand what's driving that, then we can't design the outcome. We can't design the pathway forward that leads to more effective leadership behaviour.
And that cycles right back to what you were saying around the 10% we can learn in the classroom or the training room versus at the end of the day we need to sit with the individual and actually find out what's going for that individual, because that's what it's coming back to, because it could be different to three people sitting next to each other.
Exactly. One person that might be about, and I'm really not clear on that, what the outcome, and until I have a clear outcome, I can't make a decision. Whereas for someone else, it is all about the importance of consensus decision making.
Yeah, and it's a real challenge then. It throws up that whole concept that you are talking about with fearless leadership, that we're willing to have that conversation to actually find out. Whereas I know a lot of people won't even go to that level of conversation with people.
Absolutely. And you know, what if when we have that conversation, I feel uncomfortable? And what if I make her uncomfortable? What if she makes me uncomfortable? What if she thinks I'm harassing her? And because there seems to be much more of fear of having conversations that don't need to be confrontational.
Yeah.
That actually just need to be compassionate and caring and open and honest. And most people can hear that.
Yeah. I think it's almost like it's that follow-on from emotional intelligence of, am I willing to do what it takes in a respectful way rather than not dealing with it or whatever. So that's the fearlessness that I'm actually willing to be in a vulnerable space to have that conversation. Sounds so crucial.
That's it. And people can avoid the conversations for many reasons. But one of the reasons we avoid the conversations is we actually just don't know how to have the conversation and we don't know what to take into the conversation. And that's where this book helps, because it's a practical guidebook for having those conversations. There's the framework for having the conversations, and then there's let's look at each derailer and what's driving it and how you can talk about this. And then what are the coaching tips? Let's say we decide that her indecisiveness is a result of the need to be perfect and the fear of making a decision that is imperfect. Then here's some coaching tips that she can then take away and work on for releasing that need for perfection. So there's the flow right through to, all right, so you've diagnosed that we've got this particular leadership derailer is happening. We've been able to discover what the implications of that are and then decode what's the motivation that's behind that. And then the design is about what can we do with that? What is the developmental activity that you can undertake predominantly on the job that will support resolving those challenges?
So it sounds like it's something that if I picked up the book, I could actually run with it and work with my team with it.
Absolutely. The idea is that you might want to read it cover to cover.
Yep.
Or you might actually, in the case of the woman I met with this morning, she was just going to, when she got back, was going to go straight to the chapter that described her person. Because when she was telling me the story and so of the challenges that she was facing with him. And so when I listened and then I picked up the book and I opened it to the page, each of the derailers has a full page picture, sort of cartoon. It's not a cartoon, it's a picture. I was going to say a full-page spread, but that conjures up all sorts of things that it might or might not be. But that talks about what's he saying, what's she thinking, what's she saying, what are the team saying. And when I read her some of those, she just kept nodding and saying, that's it, that's about him, that's exactly what they say. Yes, that's what his direct reports have told me. So for her, she was just going to go straight to that chapter and read that in order to have the performance review conversation with him. Someone else might go directly to another chapter. Someone else might say, well, I actually want to think more about the approach to coaching before I get specific about a particular challenge.
One
of the ideas that guided how we were originally going to put the book together was Belinda talking about those books that any of us who are parents have probably got one on the shelf where you say, you know, my kid has a fever. Now, I don't need to read this whole doctor, you know, home parent medical book. I just need to flick to the book, the chapter about fevers.
Yep.
Because today my child has a fever and that's all I need to be concerned about right now. And so the idea that it could be used as a general leadership development tool, or it could be specifically, my child has a fever today. What do I do with fevers? You know, my person's a micromanager. Yes, the rest of the book looks fabulous, but all I care about right now is the implications of having a micromanager on my team, and that's where I'm going to focus.
That sounds perfect for what a book should be today, because the stats are almost worse than engagement about the number of books that are getting read. But if you're providing a resource that someone can dip in and out of, that's actually way more useful.
Yes.
And I've got to ask you, how was it to write a book with two other collaborators?
Fabulous. Fabulous, and it probably took longer than it would have had we done it on our own, just because we were balancing schedules and occasionally we wanted to make a collective decision. But it was really good. When we sent the final draft to the editor, there were very few significant changes made by the editor. And I think that's because each page of it or each chapter of it was written by one of us and then reviewed by the three of us together.
Oh, fantastic. So that's the benefit of working together, if you can actually work together.
Absolutely. And I think we have held ourselves and, more importantly, each other to much higher standards. Like, I think I am a much better coach, a much better speaker, a much better facilitator, trainer, because I have worked with these two women.
Oh, fantastic.
They have lifted my standards, and they would say the same, that working with me has collectively, we've lifted the bar for each of us individually and for us as a group. Mm. It's been fabulous. And my husband commented just recently that when we finished the book, that we weren't desperate to be out of each other's lives. You know, thank you, and I don't have to spend time with her anymore. It's just not like that. We've now developed a program which we're yet to launch because we're once the book is really out there in the market, then we'll launch the program, which is all about supporting leaders to develop leaders. And so that's our next initiative together, which we will deliver both collectively and individually.
I think there's almost a book in the story of how you work together, because I hear so few good examples of people collaborating well on stuff, and that really is the challenge of our times as well.
Well, I'd hope, and I guess there's lots of, like, I think of NLP and Bandler and, was it Bandler and Grindley, people who, you know, who have excellent skills but don't seem to be able to use it in partnership. But
yeah.
I'd like to think that because of the skills that we have in communication and in being clear on what our objectives are and being able to work together, that, you know, it makes sense that we can write a book like this together. I think it would be sad if we couldn't. It wouldn't be much of a testament to our ability to support others.
Yeah, that's one way of looking at it. I think it's more, I was thinking, well, you actually pulled it off, so that is a real good testament that, yes, you did it. But I see so many examples of it not working, so... And you've, like, third book together, so that's, you've obviously got something that works there. So congratulations to all three of you.
Thank you. I'll pass that on.
Yeah. And so, natural question, how can someone get a copy of your book and get in contact with you?
So they can get in contact with me through my website, which is www.corinnearmer.com. And I do have to say this, that Corinne has two R's and two N's. But I get so many people telling me, you've given me your wrong email address, your website doesn't work.
Yeah.
Two R's and two N's. And I'm on LinkedIn. And you can get the book via Amazon.
Yep.
So it's on Amazon now. And we are just in the final stages of negotiating a deal so that it can be available in Australia without the need to be shipped from the US and with US exchange rates. So, and that's yet to be announced, but that will be on my website.
Fantastic. So, Corinne with two R's and two N's. I've actually got a similar name. It's Jeff with a G and it's McDonald MC, and, you know, you get used to it after a while. So thank you very much for being on the show. I really enjoyed hearing about your exploits, and congratulations. It's writing a book's one thing. Writing three books is even more spectacular, and writing it with two other co-authors I think is tops it all. So well done.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Well, there you have it, folks. Corinne Armer talking about fearless leadership, and in particular her latest book, Developing Direct Reports, Taking the Guesswork Out of Leading Leaders. And I really love the way that the book was written, that it was both something you could read from cover to cover, which is your traditional book, but it was also like a diagnostic tool where you could pull it out, have a look at it, flick through to the page that you want, get some insight into what action you could take straight away, and off you go to go and do it. So great job, Corinne. That's it. Thanks for listening. This has been Jeff McDonald and the Ideas Architect podcast, episode number 5. If you go over to our website, jeffmcdonald.com, and check out the show notes, you'll have the links to the video of the first follower, some links to Marshall Goldsmith, and of course to Corinne's website. You can also go over to Stitcher.com or iTunes to subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you again very soon. Bye.